Hello and welcome to Earth Hour Radio. This is your host, Gabby Strong. Suzanne Calkins can't join us today. She's adventuring in Bishop. But today I have a special session with artists and curator, co-conspirators, and organizers from the Monte Vista Project and High Desert Test Site, USERA Project, Spectacular Subdivision. And that was a project that was held in multiple locations over a three-day weekend in April, April 4th through 6th, out in Wonder Valley, California. And to give you an overview of that project, High Desert Test Sites, Monte Vista Projects, and University of California Institute for Research in the Arts presented Spectacular Subdivision, a group project curated by Jay Lizzo, who is one of the artists curator here with us today. This three-day exhibition invited artists to reflect on questions of housing and real estate in the aftermath of the 2008 housing market crisis. What does housing mean to artists in relation to their practice? How has the mortgage meltdown affected artists? How have forms of domesticity and shelter shaped artists' practices? Spectacular Subdivision stems from the many conversations Jay had with other artists about purchasing a home. These conversations, ranging from the various types of paints used for interiors to how to expand a house to incorporate a studio, and how to find balance between a living and working space, were simultaneously banal and fantastical. The project both engages and mimics the logic of real estate development as it has played out in the years since settlement began on the edges of habitable space across the Californian desert, e.g. California City in Kern County and Salton City, the failed resort adjacent to the Salton Sea in the Imperial Valley. The call invited participating artists to explore their personal fantasies in tandem with that illogic. And again, the project took place over a weekend at two sites in Wonder Valley, California, on the fringes of the high desert. Large-scale sculptures were installed in a cul-de-sac formation at the remote, undeveloped Iron Age road parcel, and additional works were on view at El Paseo Ranch, a rental cabin owned by the Sibley family. So today with me, I have Patrick Gilbert, I have Laura Banks, I have Megan Muller, Nate Page, High Desert Test Sites, Aurora Tang, and Jay Lizzo from Monte Vista Projects. Welcome, everyone. Thank you.
Hello.
And we have Dick Hebdige on the phone with a wonderful conference call. Hello, Dick. All right. So let's start it off. So Jay, maybe you could tell us the background concept of this project and what really drove you to create this idea, and then what led you to invite artists to respond.
The initial idea came from my wife and I trying to buy a house maybe in 2012, and just kind of just talking to friends basically and how to buy a house and the whole process of doing that. And in a way I saw it kind of parallel to a lot of like art, how art is kind of speculated on and how prices are speculated on with art objects. So I was like, oh, that's, you know, that was kind of interesting. So So then I made a proposal to High Desert Test Sites for the last year, but it didn't work out. So, but luckily it didn't work out. So I decided to Aurora and I talked, and we talked about doing a collaboration or show with Monte Vista and High Desert Test Sites in the future. And so I figured it should be kind of more of a group show, like a discussion between artists rather than just me in the desert by myself in Frauke. So that's kind of where it all started. And I kind of asked a lot of artists that I knew that either were dealing with that, like the mortgage crisis in particular, or had made objects kind of around the idea of domesticity, or were working on making their house kind of as an art project in a way. And so so those were kind of like the three main categories. And then hosting it at the desert too with Dick, Frauke and I've always been kind of visiting the desert and going to renting Laura Sibley's cabin, and just always thought that was kind of a fascinating and interesting like dream space, or like the possibilities seem always kind of there were a lot of it, it seemed like. And so so it kind of made sense just to rent one of the cabins and to represent art that was 2D, like for a practical purpose of the show, and then and have like a gathering point, and then kind of venture out into the open area where kind of like the cul-de-sac formation would, for the large scale stuff, would be installed. So that's about the gist of it.
And how did both Dick and Aurora High Desert Test Sites get involved? You've all been co-conspirators,
yeah,
of desert practices for a while.
I just kind of emailed you, right, Aurora?
Well, we've been wanting to work with Monta Vista Projects and Dick Hebdige for a while. And when he submitted an initial proposal for the High Desert Test Sites 2013 event. And with that event, we got so many proposals, and some of them were really, really wonderful, but just not appropriate for that. We couldn't fit them all in for that event. And so we held on to a lot of those proposals with the hope that we'd be able to invite these artists back, or invite them to realize these ideas at some other point. And it just seemed like good timing, and you know, especially just looking at the current state of things there. And and then it just all worked out really naturally with Dick getting involved. And Jay's been a longtime volunteer with High Desert Test Sites too, and so we've just always wanted to work with them. And it's also expanding the artists we work with. One thing that was really wonderful about involving Monta Vista and UCIRA is just that there were a lot of artists that we had never worked with before, who had never been to High Desert Test Sites, and it was a way of opening it up to new ideas. And that goes into one thing that High Desert Test Sites is interested in, and it's the many different ways there are of working and living. And for us, opening it up to people that, you know, live in Santa Barbara, who live in Los Angeles, who live abroad as well, and creating a dialogue with the place and the people in Joshua Tree and the High Desert has always been interesting to us. So it all worked out really easily.
Yeah, pretty smooth.
Can I just come in? Yes, please.
Okay, well, UCIRA, UC Institute for Research in the Arts, which I represent, we came in quite kind of opportunistically later in the day. Jay is a UC Santa Barbara alum, and I'm part of the art department, so I've known him for 50 years. And I have a place out in Joshua Tree. I'm the sort of near neighbor of Andrea Vittel, actually. And I've been there since the late 90s, so I'm one of the first wave artists gentrifiers of that area, I guess. You know, over the years, UCIRA developed interdisciplinary desert studies as an opportunity, really, to engage with that landscape, and with, you know, both with it as a literally kind of red-hot landscape, given climate change, given the role of, you know, the way in which deserts now figure so prominently in discussions about, you know, world, you know, culture clashes or fight for resources. You know, we're right up against the 29 Mark Palms Marine Base, where they rehearse for wars in other deserts. So it seemed a great opportunity to engage sort of indirectly with the kind of crisis, I guess, you know, as a civilization, with a planetary crisis in a sense, at the same time, to engage a landscape where, you know, which artists have really turned into an icon of the American experience, the American experiment, and the American West, certainly since the 1960s. You think of people like Smithson, Terrell, Nancy Holt, Walter de Maria. Obviously, it's a privileged site for certain big statements about the future of America and American history. So we're trying to engage both with the desert as a place, as an actual place, but also as a site of projections. And we're wave sites where we try to assemble students at the remote location crossroads where the lowercase deserts that we actually inhabit and see meet, you know, the desert as a concept, the capital B desert, the place where, you know, the major monotheistic religions come from, the site that's seen as a recreational site, as a real estate opportunity, as a sanctuary, as a spiritual retreat, as a test site. So all of that comes together in this landscape. And so it's very rich, and even though it is also very barren at some levels, and it's a place where people who can't afford to live elsewhere gather. So there's a kind of apocalyptic undertone of what's surrounding us in the desert, I think. And this is just the latest iteration. You, Gabby, were involved in an earlier iteration in 2010 when we did the dry immersion around Wonder Valley. So it's part of a long-term kind of commitment to that landscape and that place. And I'm just glad that Jay allowed our lots to participate to the extent that they did. And I think it was a collaboration both with Monte Vista Projects and with High Desert Test Sites that we hope to repeat again if possible.
Yeah, I hope so too.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, shut up. I'm out of the room, so I can't see whether people are rolling their eyes and looking at their watches.
No,
shut up.
Oh, no. Everyone is here smiling. Nodding their heads. And no eyes are rolling. Well, Dick, that's a really good prelude into your specific project and your performance, Short Sale. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is something I've been doing for a while, actually, since 2008. It's a short kind of 8-10 minute performance piece where I read out foreclosure notices and ads from local newspapers of the desert, and I time it with the explosion scene at the end of the Risky Point, Antonioni's film set in, you know, made in 1968, out in the desert, which has this apocalyptic ending in the desert, with everything blowing up in slow motion to the Pink Floyd. So pretty appropriate and iconic countercultural piece of footage, and use it to make a comment about value and property, and, you know, the catastrophe of came about from the manipulation of financial derivatives and so on in 2008, and then extend from there into a kind of auto critique of overconsumption in general, because Antonioni includes images, of course, of exploding televisions, bookshelves, and clothing racks, washing machines, supermarket shelves, and so forth. So, partly, you know, our motto for desert studies is more from less than zero. So, rather like punk, there is a kind of a critique of overconsumption and growth for growth's sake, and a kind of uncivilization, if you like, trajectory in what we're trying to do, to use the desert as a kind of ground zero. Let's go back and start again from scratch, because that's really what we're being compelled to do, I think, with as we come up against so many limits in our culture, in our approach to resources and so forth.
Right.
So, you know, I'll try and do in 10 minutes what I've just done in about 25, talking at length, over the phone.
No, but I mean, I think that's a really interesting method of critique is, and I think there's a similar dialogue that's found in Jay's work and in his firework Catan House too, and a number of the other projects. I think Dead Garden is also one, and Patrick's project too. I mean, all of them, Megan's as well.
Yeah.
Jake.
Yes, gunshot, buried house or exploded house.
Yeah, very much so.
Another example, yeah.
Yeah, the piece I ended up making was the original proposal, and it's basically it's modeled off this game piece from Settlers of Catan, and the piece that's enlarged is like the settlement house where you kind of plop down once you are ready to settle a piece of property in the game. I don't know, games are kind of important to me lately, and then I chose to kind of infuse these images of fireworks that were based off the housing market in LA from 2001-2005. They're turned on its side, and so at the end of each year, or at end of each graph bracket, it ended up in this kind of explosion. So the whole idea was that the viewer would kind of walk into the piece and then kind of immerse himself in this kind of colorful spectacle of color with the fireworks and the information of all the speculation on housing sales in Los Angeles. So and I think a lot of people enjoy just like kind of laying in there when it was really hot and cool, and it's like a show, like a refuge for some people. Yeah, there's pretzels and water. I was thinking of it as a video piece, like a sculptural video piece that would kind of like move over time, but I don't know if it was successful in that way sense, but maybe should I pass the mic to other
maybe Megan's piece. Tell us about your piece. We have so much in common.
Sure.
In the desert.
I worked with a deck that originally initiated in my studio. I'm new to California, and I'm very new to Santa Barbara and then the desert. So its initial iteration was very social, very functional. And then when I found out about the opportunity to potentially show with spectacular subdivisions, it seemed, I guess in thinking about housing, for me, the idea of owning a house seems very abstract or unattainable. So it seemed like a really interesting spin to take this object from my studio, remove the function, and have it be something to be looked at instead of to be used. I fought the desert the whole time.
Yeah, it was very windy.
It was very windy. My piece blew over twice, and it was, when it was on its side, it was 15 feet in the air, I think maybe about 300 or 400 pounds. And I looked at the weather report for the week, and it said 5 to 10 mile an hour winds. We were there the weekend before in like 30 mile an hour winds. And so I underestimated what 5 to 10 could actually do. So my piece blew over twice.
It's something I think it was remarkable because the materials that everyone used were really materials that were part of the desert, and they could be of any sort of site in the desert or parcel where people have property and buildings. And I think it was interesting that the wind became, like, the elements became part of everyone's projects, of everyone's pieces, because it really manipulated people's works to such a degree that it went beyond the scale of what an artist can do in many respects, and had an influence on the work that I think was very interesting. It was very interesting to see your deck go from being upright as a sculpture to being horizontal again and blending very much into the landscape like other parcels that have fallen into the land itself. So
that was one of the kind of ironic parts about because we were kind of working hand in hand. There's a group of about 6 or 7 of us. And the bulk of my material was tumbleweeds that were like made to be blown away. And I got so paranoid because I was in that wind as well, and we saw what it did to, like, I mean, you could barely walk at certain points, so I was like, I have tumbleweeds out here, this isn't gonna work. So I overdid it, and I overcompensated, and they just, for some reason, they were one of the most stable things in the show, which is kind of frustrating, but.
But it was, I mean, I think that was just, I mean, it's interesting how that relationship formed, through all of these pieces. I mean, as Dick was saying, that there's a critique of the site, there's a critique of the land, there's this push and pull between an actual place and a projection of an idea on that place, on the desert.
Kind of like mirage.
Yeah, they're mirages, or this dialectic between all the pieces and then as a group together. And it's just very interesting because you can't, I mean, as a viewer, when, you know, I couldn't put my finger on any one piece and say, oh, it's this or oh, it's that, any of that. And together, I think they were really strong and diverse, and that kind of approach to thinking about the desert and materials and
kind
the wind being part of
it. Meandering through the whole space, that's sort of how you operate in the desert and from the get-go, sort
yeah.
of. So being able to do that and kind of behave in that natural way and then kind of stumbling upon these little...
Oh, yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
Yes,
please.
Materials.
So that kind of, when we work with artists in the desert, one thing that's always becomes a challenge is figuring out a way to make it work and to endure the elements. And there are all kinds of challenges, like the wind you mentioned, that it's unpredictable. There's also vandalism. Mm-hmm. And so it's always interesting to see how, you know, artists have to become very resourceful and resilient, like people that live out there. You'll notice there's all different kinds of building methods you'll see. And some of them, I took an architecture class out there recently to look at these different types of construction and living, and it's a lot of them are just invented based on necessity and what you have out there. And it was interesting, some of the artists I spoke to about their process and how their projects evolved after they were out there, and just yeah, just dealing with how you can make work there. And ultimately, all the projects ended up being temporary, even though some of them were really, really substantial. But that's kind of this thing we've learned over the years doing high desert test sites, that, you know, we, as sturdy as these things can be, eventually the elements win. And so these projects, interventions have been kind of the way seems to be how it works out there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, for sure, definitely. And I mean, I think Laura and Nate, like you both approach, you know, from as a read, you know, it seems like both of you are approach it maybe from this notion of projection that Ick was saying, that the desert as this place of projection. And Laura, yours is almost a literal projection in an architectural drawing on the ground. And Nate, yours is a projection as a theater. So this idea of staging something there. You do both talk about that? That would be really interesting. Talk about your projects in that way, your way.
No, you go.
Lara
and Nate.
Lara, sorry.
So mine actually is my house that I bought when the market crashed in Highland Park, and which actually, buying my house enabled me to do a lot of projects with plants. So I developed a project called the Portable Forest, which I where I had a lot of plants that I stored at my house as my artwork, and things started dying, and also, which is natural, as part of the project, and things that I'd given away as part of the Portable Forest, because the Portable Forest, some of the projects were about giving away things as a gift and human responsibility and culpability in terms of caring for living things. And I had a friend who told me that one of the trees had died, and what should she do with it? It has a pot where I carved things on the pot or whatever. And so I started to think about my responsibility to that project as well. And when Jay asked me to do something in the desert, I was thinking, it's really ridiculous for me to bring the Portable Forest out there and, oh, here are all these live plants, let's place them down, because it is sensing them to death, pretty much, because it's really hard for me to do these projects anyway and have things live. So I decided, okay, I will use these plants that I've been saving from the Portable Forest, and I will invite other people to give me things that they have been trying to raise at their house, or things cut trees down that they have died, and plants that have died. And I wanted it to be unintentional, but there's some people who were killing things off they wanted to plant like a vegetable garden. Which, you know, but this is all a part of the human experience, right? So So, you know, I thought, okay, how appropriate, bring it out to the desert where things are, you know, put a holly tree out there levitating off the ground, which should really not be in this particular environment. And, you know, so I decided to landscape as if it was my house. And a lot of the things that are there are, like the potted plants are all things that were donated that were potted. And if they go in an indoor location, they went inside the structure. And so, like, you know, some of the plants that you see inside actually did die in those indoor locations in my house, as well as some outside. So it's a graveyard. I really mm-hmm. wish I could have opened it up much larger and had it be like I dream of a large scale kind of permanent graveyard for plants. But also, like, you know, accepting death as part of this process, and yeah. and about the, you know, inhabiting the uninhabitable, which is sort of like what this whole show is about, and then that difficulty and struggling with these things. And basically, I wanted it to just be ruins, you know, just homestead mm-hmm. kind of ruins, mm-hmm. which includes vegetation, because if you look anywhere there, there's still people are trying to, I mean, that's part of it, is, you know, trying to plant something or have some sort of life.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the lure of California's gold, you know, it's like a parcel with a fruit tree and a coop for your chickens, and you could get that out of a catalog in the early 1900s and arrive, and where's the water?
But my question is, like, should we even be out there? Should we even be living out there? And with climate change, this will be, should we even be living on this planet? You know, and how will we deal with that? So
right.
That's a larger question.
And I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, Nate, with your project, especially working with sand directly, with the dirt itself.
Mm-hmm.
What was the premise behind creating this landscape theater and the bleacher seating and having it go below grade and the dance performance and everything that was mm-hmm. there with it?
Yeah, well, I think the. It has maybe something to do with this idea of projection that you're talking about. And in a way, I think I was probably like trying to physicalize that creating a performance out of that projection
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
a way, like creating this theater that I came to think of it as a theater for the viewer and the landscape to perform their relationship together. And I positioned it so you could see this sort of postcard iconic view of a mountain range. And I'd thought a lot about it's the psychological relationship to this idea. Are you talking about like manifest destiny or other cultures have different words for it, but the importance of like this view of landscape in for one's spirit and one's like sense of self in their surroundings, you know? So I think it had something I was thinking about that, and then also the relationship below ground of 6 feet under, I felt like was symbolic of, you know, just like this psychological phenomena of perceiving something that's greater than you and mm-hmm. like having ideas behind it that motivate you to keep you alive, perhaps, you know, that it's that maybe it's this essential thing that humans just do and then we die and then we do it again.
Well, that, I mean, you know, touching on the sublime, your piece was so dangerous. That's all I could think of when I was there. It was like, I really want to go to the edge of this pit and look at, instead of looking at the landscape, I kept wanting to look at the bleachers, at the sculptural piece, right? Mm-hmm. And every time I kept walking over there, I was terrified that everything was gonna collapse and, you know, like these brief moments of terror, you know, mm-hmm. not totally delirious, but slightly, but. But thinking of that and in this relationship and then afterwards at night, like thinking like, oh, I hope no animals fall in there, you know, like kind of going off, but thinking of this aspect of the sublime and this notion of death and I mean, I think Aurora, you know, previous, when we were getting warmed up and introducing each other and talking about the projects before, dear listeners, before we got on the air, Aurora was talking about this notion of ownership and how often especially out in Wonder Valley and Joshua Tree and the surrounding cities or counties. I don't know really how to describe them, but that there's this notion of ownership. So even if something is not physically present, like a village, that there's still activity there.
Yeah, that's the thing I think we often forget, like when a landscape, a place looks forgotten or disused, that it maybe doesn't belong to anybody. But especially in Wonder Valley, it's really interesting because you'll see, as you go further east in the desert, you'll notice more and more of these homestead cabin shells that look like they have just been forgotten. And there are so many of those. It all goes back just to the Homestead Act. And oftentimes, I know I've talked to the Sibley family about this because they've been there and they know. I'll just be like, do you know, have you ever seen anyone there in 25 years? Has anyone stopped by? And oftentimes they'll say no. And I think a lot of families, you know, rushed out west during the, you know, they had a mini Homestead Act in the Joshua Tree area. And, you know, the government was essentially giving away 5-acre parcels of land for free or very little money if you could improve it. And because people couldn't do large-scale farming at that time, you know, to improving it meant just putting I think it was 400 square foot homestead cabin on it, or 250, they changed it at some point. But so many people just rushed out to put them up, and so they call them jackrabbit homesteads because they came up so quickly. And Kim Stringfellow has a wonderful book on, has done work on that. But I think a lot of people, who rushed and got the land, you know, have passed away, and their families don't even know they own this land. And
right. It's like all the forgotten mineral rights of the Midwest.
Yeah.
What was that, Dick?
But on the other hand, I would say, you know, when we did our kind of guerrilla installations around another property on Walmer Road in 2010, again owned by the Sibleys, we thought, you know, all these derelict pads and wreckage was just a sign of abandonment. But, you know, we put stuff up, and within an hour or 2 hours, people were coming up saying, you know, do you know this is somebody's property? You know, it's actually owned. It's kind of like stealth ownership. And people do actually keep an eye on their property lines, even out there. And so I think sometimes, you know, our sense of the desert is a kind of completely it's beyond property, is a little bit of a mirage. You know, it's like when you look towards the base and think it's just virgin land, and then you suddenly see the smoke from ordnance, you realize this is being used. This is occupied space. It's just that the occupation is sometimes a little bit stealth-like, or, you know, it's a little bit more surreptitious. And in a place like Santa Barbara, every inch is nailed down in somebody's property deed, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably what Esther Lee wrote a nice article about the exhibition and described Wonder Valley as a place settled by inhabitants who wish to remain in Southern California, but who cannot afford to live in the LA basin. And so there's this notion of being able to go just slightly east of west to attain property for very little money, and really have this notion of being able to have a large amount of space or to be able to be part of the land in a kind of way that certainly in LA it's like nearly impossible to do. And this, you know, going back to the theme of the show and the market crisis up and down and this relationship to, you know, so many of us or our families arrived here because someone in one generation or another wanted to make something of themselves, and the West seemed like the place to do it, or California seemed like the place to do it. And but with so many of us, like being here in the present now and being artists or having artists like incomes, it seems nearly impossible to be able to live in the city of Los Angeles in such a way.
And yet, artists are operating like they did in the Lower East Side in New York in the, you know, 50s and 60s. As with the pioneers, we move in, and with us comes gentrification. I mean, even in the desert, that's happening. And in the 15 years I've been there, I've seen it change. And, you know, in a sense, Wonder Valley is a hub on the international art scene now. You know, when we were out there on that 48th site, there were people from Vienna and Berlin kind of coming in, not many of them, but, you know, it is one of the sites, particularly for people in Northern Europe and Asia too, I think.
Yeah.
The Mahab is more of a destination, you know, for some than New York. So I think it's beginning to change, and no doubt it will, you know, that will be reflected in property values eventually, maybe not in Wonder Valley immediately. The people in Pioneer Town and Joshua Tree are buying up properties, doing them up and turning them into hipster rentals, you know, for the weekend. So yes. that's a new trend, I think.
Yes, I've stated a few of them, and every time I'm at one of them, I'm like, what am I doing wrong? Like, why am I living in this crappy bungalow in Echo Park? Like, what do I do? What kind of career change do I need to make again? But I mean, I think, you know, and Patrick, you know, please tell us more about your project as well on this relationship, because I mean, you're also dealing with this notion of defining space and using materials.
Yeah, it was kind of using those cabins as sort of a jumping off point. Even from like Google Maps, looking above at the site, you can see these slabs, which is basically the only thing left of a lot of the cabins because all the natural elements have been sort of blown away. But you can see these slabs, and they're becoming, because there's so many of them now, they're sort of becoming part of the whole environment. So I was kind of, I felt like there's two ways of working out there, either sort of leaning into the impermanence of it, or sort of interjecting like your own sort of idea of permanence. So by using those tumbleweeds, which also ironically are from Russia, because it seemed like the one material I was like, this is definitely from the desert, but it wasn't. It's non-native, which
invasive species.
Yeah, Kim Stringfellow's, she pointed that out. But yeah, so even trying to kind of work with the desert in that way and kind of draw from its resources, even that was sort of transient and wrong. But yeah, just the idea of sort of a level surface, and it was situated in a big wash, so it kind of acted like a mirage. During the heat of the day, there'd get those heat waves, so you'd kind of stumble upon it and try and make out what it was, but yeah.
I mean, all of this, it kind of goes back to, I think, the title of the show. What were you going to say, Jay?
Oh, I was just kind of thinking about how when, like, artists come out to do projects, mostly for the first time, or artists come out to the desert, there's a certain kind of, like, I guess, romanticism and idealism that happens. And, I mean, I know for me, I was always like, how can I live out here and make work? You know, it's like, so cheap. You know, I think everyone's kind of thought about that. I mean, like you said, it's like, what am I doing wrong? It's like, man, you could just like build any kind of structure out here and live out here, you know? But then I always think about the desert being as like the future a little bit, like how this place is almost, it's like, this is how the earth could look, kind of like what Lara was saying, like in like 10, 20 years, and how do you deal with that? How do you live with that? And so I always kind of thought of the desert as a little bit like this futuristic space. And I don't know, and then with it becoming like this, like international or like art space, I mean, I think it's interesting and fantastic, but then at the same time, I feel like it introduces sort of like tourism, which I'm kind of like, how is that? You know, I feel like a little conflicted, but I mean, I'm all for like artists showing their work in non-art spaces, really, and I think that's like that's my whole thing that I was interested with the whole project, I don't know, that's, I guess it's something just to think about as we go forward doing stuff in the desert.
Just to say something about that too, it's like one thing I was thinking about is somebody does sculpture, you know, and living in the city is the, you know, the dream of doing outdoor sculpture somewhere, and especially if you're not being like funded by somebody, how are you going to do that? And the limited resources within the city. But when you first told me about the, you know, doing something in the desert, I was like, wow, there's space. And you're like, each person gets an acre, and I'm like, an acre for sculpture? I mean, it's really a dream. Like, we don't have that kind of space anymore. And but we do in the desert, we don't in the city.
So. Well, I think Dick mentioned before, it was like, you know, when you put stuff in the desert, you're always competing against the desert. It's like, how does that, it never really holds up in a way. It's like you're, you have this beautiful landscape and you're kind of like, you know, you're like, oh, there's a small or a big sculpture in relation to this big mountain. And you're like, like, but you know, it, I think it's always an interesting, it's an interesting challenge for us, and how to address that is kind of is a really interesting thing.
You know, so. Yeah, like I was just thinking about Frank Chang's piece because it's so, it was such a diminutive work and also hard to find.
Yeah.
And really one of my favorite pieces there. And he had the he had the trap door that had the stream running underneath of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so. It was an incredibly beautiful work that most people missed. And it's just, but something is to me it's so insanely romantic about that is that here is this like hidden treasure, literally, it's like treasure, you know, and so like, because I definitely was thinking about that, like competing with the desert was an issue, but he didn't even choose to go that route. He like almost disguised his work, you know?
Yeah, so did Candace, I think, too.
Brilliant. Yeah, Candace was like such a generous, small, well, the work that she did out in the desert was just like, it was a donation. To like the creatures of the desert, and I kept thinking because I had camped there about the you know the lizards that I'd seen or like the little kangaroo rats that were going to be eating her like berries that she put out as a donation and
it was a meal for the lizards because so we were invading their home.
An honoring piece and
I like that idea with Candace's piece because something I think about a lot. Creating work out in Joshua Tree, and we actually don't really think about audience and drawing numbers as a big goal of ours. And so the idea of creating an artwork for a non-human entity is really interesting to me. And in a way, our projects, I mean, we like to support artists and interesting ideas that, you know, and give a space for it. But ultimately, not to downplay any of the artworks, the projects themselves are almost just a reason to push people to get out and look at, you know, the places around them and, you know, go to Wonder Valley. A lot of people, you know, have been to Joshua Tree, but don't know Wonder Valley's out there. And so the art becomes just a means of getting people out there. And again, like you said, or I think you were saying, or where did I go? But when it was in our pre- radio show conversation about how, you know, when artists were making out there, scoping out the parcel, you know, the tactics you found yourself resorting to find the parcel itself. And, you know, you couldn't rely on your GPS unit, but you had to go back and look at the landscape differently. And that's something I guess I'm interested in is just kind of using this work out there and these different projects to engage in and promote this idea of landscape literacy and looking at your environment just a little differently. And the artwork is just a means of getting, and it's another way of, you know, adding to that wonderful landscape.
And that's certainly part of what we're interested in doing too. The name of the class I offer occasionally map in the desert, deserting the map. And so getting lost is intrinsic to the whole thing, you know, getting out of your depth, getting immersed in an environment where you're not able to rely on some of the technologies that give us this illusion of total locative control that we always know where we are or somebody else always knows where we are. So I think that idea of, you know, having to negotiate an environment that isn't controllable in quite the same way or legible immediately is part of what's great about the desert and what's challenging about it.
Absolutely. I wanted to speak to the idea of landscape literacy. When we first arrived, I really felt the barrenness of the space and realized over, at least, you know, spending a lot of time there that it was actually quite alive. And so, you know, the first day, 8 hours in, you see a snake and then you see lizards and then you see beetles. And, you know, it really was quite alive and it just took you stopping and looking for it.
And in terms of, there's just a lot of people living out there too. I mean, Joshua Tree has over 8,000 residents. That's actually really a lot of people. Yeah. And there are people out there. There's a Joshua Tree transition group that is doing active permaculture, and it is a very vibrant place, but it's just very varied in terms of, again, the places people live, the ways people live out there. And I guess that's why the show was so interesting to us, just further exploring these different, the physicality of the places and structures and the people of different ways of living. So,
Jay, could you maybe talk about the title?
Oh, sure. Well, the title kind of came about with thinking about like California City and Salton Sea areas where all this like speculation of like neighborhoods would happen or has happened. And then, I don't know, the word spectacular, I was thinking of just the society, the spectacle, and just the very much like the kind of hoopla that happens around like almost like betting, I guess, like gambling. It's just kind of like, it's kind of a spectacle. And then I envisioned the whole kind of setup as being like a subdivision of like idealized projects. Initially, in my mind, it was supposed to form like a cul-de-sac in the lot. But I mean, it sort of did. But it was when you walked around, you couldn't really tell. But and that I was kind of okay with that kind of not happening, but because a lot of it was still speculation on what would be made and shown. So, yeah, that was kind of the whole idea. It was just like each area where each artist did their project was kind of like their little property where they were can make their own like sculptural home idea. And spectacular subdivision. I was like, yeah, first try. It wasn't like. I didn't have to strain too hard for that one.
It was a great first try.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Thanks.
Especially in this context of like this, the desert not supposed. It has this ring to it of it's not spectacular. It's very bland. It doesn't have like these monumental mountains. It's but once you stop and look, that myth gets dispelled, and it's really quite stunning. And the geology is incredible. The ecology is varied from, you know, high desert to low desert and everything in between. And then reflecting back on the notion of subdivision too, and are there any sort of, you know, modern suburban style housing developments there, or is it everything just on this grid that expands up until it reaches?
So yeah,
Yucca Valley has those, and then as you go further east, it just kind of dissipates, I think.
Yeah.
But
okay.
It's kind of interesting, you know, talking about California City, Salton Sea, these failed or so-called failed resort towns that are these ruins that have been increasingly of interest to, I think, artists and creative researchers, and you know, like Zizek's out, you know, on off the 15, this failed resort town, how it's been utilized for arts research, and you know, the Salton Sea has been of so much interest to, you know, I always hear about all these new projects going out there, and I mean, Dick has been working in all of those too, so it's interesting to see Wonder Valley put in that context of kind of, and also specifically the idea of the homestead cabins have been of interest to artists, I think.
Yeah. And you mentioned there's another art collective interested in doing something at California City.
I met an artist who was involved with that space. I'm blanking out on the name, but an artist came to me a couple months ago when Jay and I were just getting started talking about this, and he was interested in doing a group show out in California City. And then there's also this artist I met throughout this process, Dennis Rudolph, who is doing his own project out in California City as well. And so it's been interesting seeing that. And Kim Stringfellow has another book on the Salton Sea, and just a lot of interesting things are happening in these places.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, I guess I just keep thinking about it as like a big futuristic kind of like lab out there. I mean, I remember hearing that, you know, when you kind of build structures out there, you, like, there's hardly any permit or like inspectors to come and check what you're
making.
The code
is really lax.
Yeah, the code's lax, so you could make.
But that's not true, actually.
Oh, it's not true.
No, it's not, and that's a myth. That I mean, working with Andrea Zatel, like she's kind of become an expert on building code, and so sometimes, so when we work on projects, you actually have to make sure. I mean, if we do things not to code, we always tell our artists, okay, you know, make it. Like a neutral color, so it's not visible from the highway. Because again, you want to avoid building inspector code people coming out there and taking a look at it. But also, you don't want to attract vandals, because if kids see a bright orange big box, you know, in the desert, they're gonna go and say, "What's that?" and mess with it. So it actually is a myth.
Scratch what I said.
You can't do anything out there. It goes back to the idea that, you know, oh, okay, everybody. The desert land belongs to somebody. You can't just put things up, or sometimes you can, but you can't just. It's not anything goes.
Yeah,
all the time.
Yeah. I mean, that brings me back to I think the original concept and this idea of creating work that is addressing this notion of speculation and real estate futures, right? And how art is also bound up in that, because much of what we do is collected by people who put work in their homes. And the caliber of the home increases the quote-unquote caliber or the blue-chip quality of the art that's embedded in it. And, you know, I think part of what we were talking about earlier, this notion of manifest destiny in California really being the end of the line in that philosophical approach, but yet every time people are coming to California, reinventing that moment of establishing a kind of place here, that feedback, it just becomes a feedback loop over and over again, where it's constantly future past simultaneously in the present. And I mean, I think that I'm interested in that notion that you're thinking about is the desert as this futuristic kind of place. It's this futuristic landscape.
I think the desert, it seems to do a really good job of sort of recontextualizing that, whether or not it's the art or if it's sort of looking at the real estate market and then placing that sort of way back in time and framing it in the desert kind of brings up new things that you would miss if you were sort of analyzing it from Los Angeles or Santa Barbara or anywhere. So I think that was something that struck me was what all the work about the housing market was doing out in that landscape and that environment. So
yeah, for sure.
The desert is a kind of graveyard of intention, good and bad. You know, if you think about the salt and sea as a consequence, unintended consequence of the hydro engineering attempt to make the desert boom. So at that level, you know, there is something about the indifference of the desert to all these attempts to do this amazing stuff. Another level, it's a place of kind of resurrection and repurposing, because, you know, it takes so much effort and energy to haul stuff up that grade from Morongo into the upper desert that once it gets there, it's a bit like Cuba. People keep they keep things working way beyond the time that they're supposed to have been retired. And so, yeah, I think it has got this sense of being both the place of origin and ending, and it's a place where we just have to make do and learn as much as possible.
Dick, you should copyright Graveyard of Intention. It should be you should just copyright that now.
Well, thank you all for joining us. Jay, do you have any last comments?
Pretty much. Thanks for inviting all of us.
Thanks for everyone for coming. I'm so glad there's so many people here in the K-Chung studio, and we have a conference call, and everything was working.
Yeah.
Oh, I was from a remote location. I hope I didn't go on too long. It was a privilege to work with Jay and with High Desert Test Sites, and now with Gabby and the radio station. So yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh. Jay.
Oh, I was just thinking also about Manifest Destiny a little bit.
Manifest Destiny.
I was just thinking how it's more like for me, the way I think about it, it's like a little bit more fictional or like internalized, like how, like manifesting something almost within a dream or like as a fantasy. So it doesn't, it's not necessarily a real space anymore. Like,
right.
It's kind of like something that's idealized, like wherever it could be.
Yeah. Way.
So that's how I was kind of thinking about
it. Yeah. Sounds like California.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us today. Next 2 weeks from now, we'll have another wonderful episode, and Suzanne will be joining us again from Bishop. This is Gabby signing out with Earth Art Radio on K-Chung AM 1630.